good. So here we are on the Glasgow Buddhist Centre rainy season retreat on, I think it's the 16th of April, 2018. Yeah. And who knows, there might be people listening to this talk in years to come. Think, oh yeah, it was really old and quaint back then, wasn't it? they had those funny hairstyles back in 2018. So that's why I like to put a date on it like that. This is the second day of our rainy season retreat, the annual gathering of the core Sangha of the Glasgow Buddhist Centre, the Uddha Mitra Sangha. And the theme this year is 21st Century Ethics, Bodhisattvas in Training. And I launched the whole thing yesterday with an introductory talk, which is now online, and you can, if you missed it, you can still listen to it. So what I'll do tonight is just kind of like refer to what I said yesterday, and then just continue from there. So basically what I was saying yesterday is, in terms of ethics, I was saying that ethics is, as I understand it, having been studying Buddhist ethics and practicing it for quite a long time, several decades anyway, as I understand it, awareness is essentially actions have consequences. It's becoming aware of the consequences that your actions have and then taking responsibility for that. So ethical awareness is an awareness of what you're doing and the effect that it's having. The effect it's having on you and the effect it's having on other people. So actions have consequences is the essential thing. And as it's part of the Buddhist tradition, Buddhist ethics is about freedom. It's about freedom of choice. It's about respect for the individual. It's not about being told what to do by somebody and then having to do it because, well, I've just got to because I've been told. That's, if you like, childhood ethics. That's school ethics. It's also the way that the state and the police kind of runs the country. But it's not Buddhist ethics. Buddhist ethics is free choice. It's a matter of becoming aware of what you're doing and the consequences of that, and then choosing what you want to do about that. And it really is a free choice. Having been brought up within quite an authoritarian culture with its legacy of authoritarian religion, it can take quite a long time, I find, to realise that this religion isn't like that. It doesn't have anybody telling you what to do and threatening you with punishment if you don't do it. It's taken me a few years, I think, to grow out of that sense of, that sort of sense of the fear of some kind of divine retribution. You know, so if I'm bad, then I deserve to be punished. I don't deserve love. In the Buddhist tradition, it ain't like that. Love is ideally unconditional love. So it's love for people, no matter who they are and no matter what they've done. So in Metta Bhavana, you work up to a stage, the final stage, where you're opening your heart to everybody on the planet, no matter who they are. That's unconditional love. So I think talking about Buddhist ethics, it's worth just, you know, being really explicit about these basic principles, because part of practicing the Dharma is noticing how we've been conditioned by our society, and then letting go of all the weight of all that stuff that we really don't need to be carrying around with us, all those fetters of institutionalized guilt that we've been brought up and conditioned with. So yeah, Buddhist ethics is simply the awareness that your actions have consequences, and then the freedom to choose what you want to do about that. We have the precepts, and I'm very glad to have kind of said all that before talking about the precepts, but we have the precepts, and they are voluntary guidelines that we can choose to take up and train in. They're training principles. And of course, they have a similarity to, say, the Ten Commandments, but they're not commandments. They are training principles we take up and train in. We can choose whether we abide by the precepts or not. You know, nothing terrible happens if you choose not to abide by them. Well, sometimes. But we only have the law of karma to contend with. We only have the natural law of the universe that, you know, if you practice cruelty, then you tend to suffer. Not because somebody punishes you for it, necessarily. Yesterday, Abhayavacha recited a passage from the 41st sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, called the Salayaka Sutta. Unfortunately, he was an awful long way away from the microphone, so listeners at home might not have heard that. That's why I'm saying again what the sutta was. And I'll just say what he was actually talking about, because you might not have heard. So this is the Buddha, this is in this discourse of the Buddha, he's explaining to a group of ancient Indian villagers how to practice the Ten Precepts. And he's saying, well, take care not to act with violence, theft, or harmful sexual activity. And you could take care not to speak dishonestly, harshly, uselessly, or divisively. And take care not to sink into mere hate, mere greed, or petty hatreds, or false views. You could take care to cultivate kindness, generosity, consideration in sexual matters, great considerateness in sexual matters, honest speech, kindly speech, meaningful speech, harmonizing speech. You could take care to cultivate tranquility and compassion and wisdom. So, since you've asked me what the Ten Precepts are, that's what it is. That's the training opportunity. And I reckon that, I'm paraphrasing the Buddha, I reckon that if you practice in this way, you'll have a happy time. And when you die, you'll have a happy rebirth. And in the Salayaka Sutta, it's interesting the way the Buddha's talking to them, because he says, for example, take care to act well in relation to the people in the village and in the forest. Because back then, 25 centuries ago, if you lived in a village in ancient India, this was your sphere of influence, and this is all you knew. I mean, back then, you might not even have known what was going on 100 miles away. There might have been a war going on 100 miles away, and you're completely unaware of it, because it's not impinging on your village. Maybe a local skirmish 100 miles away. You never know about it. You just carry on. And so what you do affects other people in the village, and it's, if, you know, maybe the local countryside, and that's about it. There's another discourse of the Buddha, a similar sort of situation. He's talking to people from a small town, the town called that's right. The town is called Kesaputta, and it's a particular tribe called the Kalamans of Kesaputta. And he turns up in this little township on his wanderings, and they come and ask him what he teaches. And he starts talking to them about the effect of your actions. And he just asks them to consider, you know, if you were to act with violence, with dishonesty, with theft, with sexual violence even, if you were to act in an intoxicated way, what effect do you think it would have on your town? And they say, in response, well, that sort of thing has a really destructive effect. You know, it undermines trust, it undermines relationships, people don't feel safe, it causes a lot of suffering. So then the Buddha says to the Kalamans, what do you think, if you act kindly and honestly towards the people around you, if you are very considerate in sexual matters, if you abstain from intoxication, what effect do you think that would have on your relationships and your town? And they say in reply, well, we know that that kind of thing is very helpful for our whole community. When people act like that, it does the whole town good. And people can relax and they feel safe, they can trust each other. Everything goes well when people act like that. So then the Buddha says, well, it's right there in your experience, so you could trust that, couldn't you? It's a beautiful sutta because the Buddha's doing two things at the same time. On the one hand, he's encouraging people to trust their experience. And the other thing is actually pointing to ethical practice and inviting people to notice that, you know, this kind of behaviour leads to suffering and that kind of behaviour leads to happiness and contentment and stability. So this time in this discourse, he's not talking about, well, do this and then you'll have a happy rebirth. He's saying, do this and then you'll have a good life. You'll get on better in your local neighbourhood. And this is our experience too. You know, we know that if the people in our locality are acting honestly and kindly and considerately, then everybody feels better. Everybody in the locality feels better. And if we all act like that towards our neighbours, we feel good too. So this is Buddhist ethics. It's about people who have started a practice in this way, discovering that it's helpful and then recommending it to their friends and anybody who's interested. And the Buddha was the first one, and we've been doing it ever since. And it's simply a matter of, well, this seems to work for me, maybe it'll work for you, why don't you try it? And it's not about punishing and threatening and rewarding and all that sort of thing. It's about freedom. And it's about freedom for the individual, freedom of choice. But even in the Kalama Sutta, he's talking about notice the effects of your actions. And he's talking about the town, the local vicinity. And again, people living in a little town in ancient India, that's all they know. They know what's going on in their local town. In the 21st century, we live in a different kind of world. We live in a world where all of that goes on being true. You know, so how we act affects our local neighbourhood. That goes on being true. How we act affects our household, maybe our family, our relatives, the people we work with. That remains true. And also, something that the Buddha didn't mention in the discourses, but is also an ethical matter, is how you act towards yourself. How you act towards yourself. That has an ethical dimension too. And what I mean by that is, if you're in the habit of berating yourself and treating yourself harshly and telling yourself off in a very impatient, harsh kind of a way, it doesn't do you any good. that kind of thing undermines contentment and inner harmony. And I found that an important dimension of ethical practice is the learning to speak kindly to yourself, learning to have patience with yourself. So for example, when I'd been practicing Buddhism for a few years, I dropped, I don't know if it was a cup or something like that, and it shattered on the floor. And then I looked at the crockery and I waited for all of the sort of self kind of berating to start, and there was just silence. And I thought, I'm really getting somewhere now. So I just set about sweeping it up and putting it in the bin. And I thought, I have to be more careful next time. But I didn't beat myself up about it. And that was part of the fruit of all those years of practicing metta with, first stage self-metta. You see, I think it's an ethical matter how you what psychologists call the self-talk. You know, how you persuade yourself to get up in the morning. So rather than laying into yourself and calling yourself a lazy so-and-so and all that sort of thing, you just do a bit of kindly coaxing. You promise yourself a few treats, And it's all kindness and patience. And then you start the day on a good footing. So I think ethics applies to oneself. It applies to your household. It applies to your locality, your village, your town, your neighbourhood of Glasgow, whatever it is. And that remains true now just as much as it did 25 centuries ago. But what's changed is that we are now aware that what we do affects people all over the world and affects people living in future generations. And that is just part of our society. It's part of our economics, for example. If you're living in a village and all the food you eat is grown within a few hundred yards from where you're living, then the way you go about procuring your food is just a village matter. We live in a very different world. And the example I used yesterday was when you go to the supermarket and you want to buy some bananas, you're standing in front of a range of bananas, you've got lots to choose from, and over there are the fair trade ones and they're more expensive. And you have to make a decision about which bananas you buy. And you know that if you buy the fair trade ones, the people growing those bananas, if they're covered by, say, the fair trade system of guaranteeing, then if it's working properly, then those people on the other side of the world have better welfare standards and they get more money and they have a better life. But it costs you more money to buy the bananas. So then you can choose, maybe depending on how much money you've got, you can choose to buy those bananas. And you are knowingly affecting people, maybe in South America. And that is part of our everyday life in the 21st century. It's the way it is for everybody. We're also aware when we switch the news on, we're all sort of plugged into the mass media in the 21st century, so we're aware of what's going on in other countries every day. So if there's a disaster in another country, say there's an earthquake, then there's usually a charity appeal. There might be collecting cans at the supermarket checkout. There was one of them for the tsunami, I think, in Japan. So they had collecting cans at the supermarket checkout saying, if you want to put some money in for the tsunami, you can. And that is part of the fabric of everyday life in our society we live in. We are aware of people all over the world and how what we do, what we buy, what we choose to donate to. All our sort of lifestyle decisions have effects all over the world because we belong to a global economic community now where our clothes are stitched together by people in other countries and the food we eat is grown by people in other countries and our machines are made by people in other countries. So what we choose to do, where we choose to spend our money, has global implications. And then also yesterday I was saying that since we found out about global warming, we're now aware that everything we do has an effect in terms of carbon emissions, and that affects the climate, and that affects the lives of people in 100 years from now. And we can all already see the beginnings of climate change already, you know, how some parts of the world turning into deserts gradually, and those people can't make a living anymore, and they're having to migrate. And part of the migration issue is it's climate related migration. There are other things too. It's to do with war, isn't it? And we're also aware of the wars going on, and we worry about them. It's like it's in our minds every day when we plug into the media. And yesterday I was saying that I was born in 1955, and by the time I was 10 years old, for example, I started to become aware that I was living in the nuclear age. And it's quite a huge thing for a little boy to open up his mind to, you know. But it started to dawn on me, the stuff that was coming over the TV and a few snippets my parents were saying, that there are these terrible weapons and they say that they could wipe us out. Growing up in the nuclear age is no small thing. The world of the Buddha's time wasn't like that. So even if there was a famine or a war going on, it wasn't a matter of, like, is this going to wipe out the entire human race? Since the invention in 1945 of nuclear weapons, this is the kind of thing that humanity has started to have to face up to, the possibility of its own demise. Which is really awful and really scary to kind of like even think about. Yesterday, I didn't even mention nuclear weapons. I just mentioned climate change. And even by mentioning that, even by saying that that's the time that we're living in, and it's scary, isn't it? I took great care to put that across as kindly as I could. But even so, there were people in the room who found that really very upsetting and very scary, and sort of sent them into, I think somebody said, emotional shutdown. It's only natural. Where you start to confront the reality of our age, the age that we're living in the 21st century, that kind of reaction is only natural, you know, and it's happened to me over and over again. It's probably happened to all of us. And it probably still happens. You know, you hear something on the news, on the radio or on the TV, and it's shocking and appalling, and you go into emotional shutdown, and you just think, I can't deal with this. You switch off, and you do something as an escape from what's going on in the world. And you need that. Every so often you need an escape from what's going on in the world. You need to go off and enjoy yourself and forget all about it because, you know, we need a break sometimes. It's not easy living in the 21st century and being aware of what's going on in the world. So we have to take good care of ourselves, and this is where Dharma practice comes in. Dharma practice is about looking after yourself, considering the supportive conditions you need to gradually become a bold and courageous and compassionate hero who can stand there and look reality in the face and empathize with people who are suffering without caving in. In other words, a bodhisattva. And it's work in progress, isn't it? And we're not like that yet. We're still training. But that is what the Dharma is for. It's a training in how to be a really effective human being who is strong and courageous and compassionate and wise and has a massive contribution to make in the world. It's a gradual process, and a key part of the process is looking after number one. Sure, it's not only looking after number one, but looking after number one is a very important part of it. So that's why, part of ethics is looking after yourself, looking after your health, your contentment, noticing what makes you feel scared, noticing what restores you to a sense of contentment and courage and peace again. And then as you get to know those things, the way the conditionality of mental states works, you learn to work with your mind more and more effectively. That's the bodhisattva training. So when something shocking, like something on the radio or the TV, sends you into a tailspin, sends you into terror or emotional shutdown, as a Buddhist, it's about noticing that happened and then taking the initiative, when you get the chance to take the initiative, and then doing something about it to restore your courage and contentment again. So this is the training, and no doubt even 25 centuries ago in the Buddha's time, people had shocks. Suddenly somebody would suffer a terrible accident. Maybe it was somebody near and dear to them, and suddenly they were sort of mortally injured right next to them. And people had shocks, and they had to deal with fear, and part of their Dharma practice was having to cope with that. But in some ways, living in the 21st century, with the awareness that we have of global conditions, that kind of awareness of suffering is there in the background pretty much all the time. And part of living in the 21st century and practicing 21st century ethics is looking after yourself in the nuclear age. Somebody was saying yesterday, well, I just don't listen to the news anymore very often. Is that an unskillful thing to do? And my response is probably not. Maybe because, like, there's a limit to how much bad news. Most of the stuff that comes over the TV is bad news, let's face it. There's a limit to how much of that you can handle. And even people like me saying things like, oh, we might not survive this planetary crisis. Well, there's a limit to how much you can handle that kind of thing too. So, do take responsibility for your own welfare in this. Look after yourself. But I don't think we just have to go into emotional shutdown as a permanent solution to the problem. Because if everybody in the world just turned away from the plight of humankind, and the plight of the earth, then humankind would be abandoned to all of the machinations of the consumer society. And it needs, humankind needs strong, courageous people who can face these things and respond creatively and well. In other words, humankind needs bodhisattvas. The world needs us. The world needs us. We have the good fortune to have discovered a way of practicing. We've discovered a healthy religion. We've discovered a religion that actually just looks after people. It doesn't just coerce them into doing what the religious authorities want them to do, but actually respects their individuality and gives them resources and invites them to use them with no obligation. Brilliant. That's what a healthy religion is like. We've stumbled our way into one. It's fantastic. We've got a wonderful opportunity, and the world needs us. The world needs us to use those resources well and become the bodhisattvas that those practices are there for. I thought I'd say something about my personal journey, my personal story, and how I started to get into all this. I don't mean just get into Buddhism, but also get into turning towards the big ecological issues and learning how to face them courageously. It was little by little. When I was young, when I was a teenager, I started to realise when I was just a boy that I was living in a world in which there were nuclear weapons, and that was really scary. And I tried to forget about it most of the time, which most people do. You know, notice you just carry on as if it isn't like that, and then, you know, every so often you get a nasty reminder. It'd be something that Donald Trump is tweeting. Says he, I was just rolling my eyes then. But, you know, so I grew up in the nuclear age and did the best I could. And then I started to think in my teens about what I wanted to do with my life. And I just thought, well, it's not enough to just get a good job and plenty of money and a comfortable lifestyle and bring up a little family in a contented kind of way and have a nice retirement with a good pension. That's not enough. There's a lot of suffering in the world, and what I do needs to respond to that in some way. But I didn't know how on earth I was going to do it, because I felt just very small and the world very big. It took me years of reflecting on that to try and figure out how to respond. On the way, I discovered Chiratma and the Bodhisattva ideal and a way of training, and that was brilliant. So I joined in with that. I worked at Karanar Trust for a while, so then I discovered that, well, you don't have to solve the problem of third world poverty just like that, but you can start with one little project over there and work away at that and fundraising for that, and then at least that is having an effect, and the example of that can spread and have an effect. So I was fundraising for Karanar Trust, raising money for welfare projects in India. In the course of that, I had the good fortune to meet Joanna Macy, who I mentioned, the author of the book I was recommending, Active Hope. She was over here on a book launch for a new book she'd written called Despair and Personal Power in the Nuclear Age. This was 1983 when I met her, and she was talking about how to face up to the nuclear age and respond to it creatively and courageously. So, unlike when I was a little boy and I didn't have any resources or really anybody to talk to about it who didn't just want to change the subject, I had somebody to talk to and I had a book to read and I had a way of turning towards that without caving in. And then I plunged into pretty much full-time ordination training and then building Sangha within the FWBO and spiritual friendship and nurturing the Sangha and bringing everybody, more and more people into the Sangha. I moved to Scotland. I started teaching retreats at Dunlacosha. I've been there for 22 years. And I know from experience that Dharma practice does people a lot of good. I mean, I see it every time I lead a retreat. It's transformational. I know that getting back in touch with nature does people a lot of good too. And it's really satisfying work, you know, what I'm doing at Dharmakosha. But then there came a time when I just became aware that I can't just immerse myself in a spiritual life that has no global and ecological awareness and just pretend as if, well, it's like the time of the Buddha, you know. I heard something on the news which really shocked me, and I thought it was actually the news that the British government had decided to build a new generation of nuclear power stations. That's what did it for me. That was kind of like the tipping point for me. And that they were going to get the Chinese to build them, or at least cooperate in building them and increasingly take over the production of them. Now, it's not as if I'm a racist, I've got nothing against the Chinese per se, but the idea of letting a foreign power build our nuclear power station for us, it seemed to me that that was an abdication of responsibility on behalf of the British government, and they were abdicating responsibility for the safety and welfare of the population. And I thought that was absolutely appalling. And I thought, I can't quite believe that's happening. And then I was overwhelmed with a sense of shame that I hadn't done more to stop that. And then I realised that that was really part of an intense sense of caring for the earth and caring for the people of the earth. Let the ambulance recede into the distance. Another one passing by. I was saying that was the tipping point for me. I could have said that was the alarm call. And I remember I live in a cabin in the woods in the Highlands, and I remember hearing that news and just walking outside of my back door among the trees and just kneeling down among the pine needles and going onto all fours and just looking at the earth and just feeling, my heart just opened and I just felt so much care for the earth. And I just realised Mother Earth needs us. She needs us to look after her. It was a huge emotional experience for me. It was a turning point. It changed me forever, I think, that moment. And I just realised I have to find out more about what's going on in the world. And in some small way, I need to engage and respond to it. So that's my story. And since then, I went back to reading Joanna Macy books, which I'd put down years before. And I bought some new ones. And what she was writing about was the kind of experience that I'd recently been having, that political decisions could be taken, and I felt helpless to do anything about it. I just felt like a small, little, insignificant little person. And then there were these huge forces in the world. And she says that is the helplessness that so many people feel and the despair that they fall into. And she was saying that that sense of helplessness and despair, which disempowers human beings, is one of the dangers of the present reality. And what she's been doing for the last four decades is bringing people together and showing them ways to do something much more constructive and creative than that despair. And the first sense is appreciative awareness. Contacting, getting, feeling the ground beneath your feet and appreciating nature. That's part of it. That's part of the healing. It's opening up to your emotions and the pain of your emotions, including your own fear and grief, but doing it communally, together, in a kind of a sangha, and recognizing that you're not the only one that feels like this. And then realizing that these feelings of grief and fear and concern, and they're because we care about the earth, we care about life, we care about humanity. And that caring, that compassion, is a force for good in the world, that the world needs that to flow properly and to be unblocked. So reactions like despair and shutdown and fear block the energy, block the compassionate energy. So the practices are about freeing that up and letting it flow again. And then acting and responding communally, so that you're doing things together with other people in solidarity. You can encourage each other and you can help each other when it all gets too much and you fall into despair again. It has to be a community thing. So I was very encouraged yet again by reading about Joanna Macy's work, and I think, yeah, let's bring that into Tiratna more and more. And then I looked around and I discovered that other people have already been bringing it in for a few years. People like Parami, Akupa, who's the founder of Ecodharma? Gukhipati, that's right. So Gukhipati is another one. These people have been bringing the work of Joanna Macy into Tiratna for about 10 years or so and more. So I'm now one of them. And then a bit later on, I was talking to Pam Chandia, I'll be interviewing her tomorrow night. Pam Chandia is a Mitra who lives over in Paisley, and she has for about 8 or 9 years been raising consciousness about climate change. And she's been bringing people together to do something a little bit similar to your Aunt Joanna Macy, bringing people together in maybe just half a dozen people meeting up weekly for a course of maybe 6 or 7 weeks and just talking about climate change and the issues involved. And part of the function of those groups is that it gives you a sort of small group of people who share their thoughts and feelings and share their emotions about it too. And they're starting to get that sense that I'm not the only one who feels like this. In other words, you establish a supportive context where you can talk about these things and it's okay to talk about without everybody getting depressed. Yeah? In a constructive way. And then part of the program of her Carbon Conversations group is to talk about climate change, global warming, and what you can do to respond to it. So week by week, they have different topics to look at, and it's partly finding out the information about how actions have consequences, so the effect of your lifestyle choices on your carbon emissions. And on a course, you measure your personal carbon footprint at the beginning, and then you do the course, you make a few changes, you measure it at the end, and you see how it's changed. So then you can see how, in a small way, you are responding. So the topics they're looking at are energy at home and work, like how you heat your house and light your house, travel and transport, how you get around, food and water, consumption and waste. So that's a matter of how much stuff you buy and how it's manufactured and what happens to it when it's thrown away. And then there's a whole week about how you talk to your friends and family about this in a way that they don't just start avoiding you. So it's constructive dialogue. You know, in our language, it's learning to speak truthfully and helpfully and harmoniously, rather than just berating people with truths and then they just avoid you. That doesn't really work, doesn't really help. So you start to, if you've done a carbon conversations course, you start to realise that you can make small changes in your life. It's a bit like the decision to go vegetarian, for example, if you've done that. So you make a few choices, you work into it gradually, and then other people in your family and your locality start to notice the decisions you've made, and they ask you about that, and you tell them why, and that has an influence on them, and they start to think about it. A little bit like when you go vegetarian and other people notice and you talk about it and they think about it. You see what I mean? So these are really ethical choices where you start to look at the consequences of your actions and you start to take responsibility for it. So you know, for example, that travelling from here to London by aeroplane is much more harmful to the environment than travelling to London by train. Now, it's an ethical matter. You are a free individual, you can choose. And sometimes, maybe you're in a hurry, maybe a relative of yours is got suddenly a terminal illness, you need to be at their bedside within hours. As soon as possible, you fly. Other times, you take a train. Depends. You weigh it up. It's always a kind of matter of weighing things up. But at least you have the ethical awareness that flying has much more harm to the environment than using a train. And apparently using express coaches even better than taking a train. I found out that this by reading this book. So last year I read the book. I live out in the wilds in the Highlands. It was quite hard for me to get to a carbon conversations group, so I just read the book. But it did have an effect on my life, and I live in a cabin in the woods, and I ride a bike, and I don't have a car, and I've probably got quite a low carbon footprint already. But I just wanted to just bring my life a little bit more in line with my awareness of the historical time we're living in. So I just made a few small changes, and I'm still making them. It's a gradual process. But already, for example, I now I'm more economical when I use gas for boiling a kettle. I remember more often to boil the kettle on the wood-burning stove, and then when it's hot, I pour it into a thermos flask and keep that all day, so that even when the stove's gone out, I've got hot water, and I pour that into the kettle and then boost it on the gas burner. So you might say, well, those are finicky little things, they're not going to make a big difference to the world. But for me, I really enjoy doing things like that. And little by little, I know that my life is becoming more in tune with what's needed in terms of the planet. And I'm much more interested in the Green Party as well. So it's affected me in quite a number of different ways. I'm now avoiding palm oil when I buy food. Again, because I've discovered the pretty disastrous effect it has when they cut down rainforest and build and plant palm oil, and all of the pollution that causes, all of the atmospheric effects when they burn the trees, when they clear the land. If you want to find out about it, it's all there. It's on the internet. Over to you if you want to follow that up. But like, I was changing buses in Stirling recently, and only in half an hour, and I had to buy some oatcakes for my lunch. I went to a shop and they only had palm oil oatcakes. I went to the next shop and they only had palm oil oatcakes, and I was running out of time, and I thought, I'm just going to buy some palm oil oatcakes. Sometimes you just compromise. And I've got used to that, you know, like if you start finding out about things, probably almost everything has got some harm somewhere. You just have to compromise. So, for example, I avoid airplanes, you know, but some of my friends fly to the Order Convention in India every 2 years, and I respect their decision. And that is, you know, it's a good cause, you know, a gathering of the Sangha. That is also a big contribution to the plight of humanity in the 21st century. Another one, just personally, I've chosen for the time being not to go vegan for health reasons. I'm aware that the dairy industry causes suffering to animals. I buy organic when I can, and I know it's an ethical compromise. And I take responsibility for that. And it's not easy, but I live with it. Because my health matters, and I'm not convinced that I can be well and strong and healthy on a vegan diet. And I'm sure some of my vegan friends will be only too happy to explain that I'm completely mistaken. They're very welcome to have a go. Prasad is grinning to me from the back of the room there. But that's where I'm up to. And it's kind of like it's a sort of progress report I'm giving you now. I wanted to kind of tell my personal story and some of my ethical dilemmas and how I've had to compromise and how it's a sort of gradual thing. And it's kind of gradual change. I think I'd like to bring the talk to a close by coming back to what I was saying a minute ago about how just teaching the Dharma and building the spiritual community is a massive contribution to the plight of humankind. There are many, many ways to respond to the situation in the 21st century. There's a whole range of them. I really like the advice Joanna Macy gives. Towards the end of her workshop, she always has a period of, she calls it going forth, where you start to, by this time of the workshop, just about every, well, if all goes well, people on the workshop, if it's been led well and everything's gone well, people by this time are feeling a lot more positive and courageous than they were when they arrived. Much more of a feeling of solidarity. And they're in a more of a sort of creative mind state, as Bhante would call it. Where they're in a state where they're much more able to think creatively and insightfully about the situation they're in and how to respond. And they start coming up with bright ideas about things that they can do. And she says, notice what calls you. There are so many ways to respond to the situation of on the planet in the 21st century. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of possibilities, lots of positive things you can do. Notice what calls you, what you feel that you feel drawn to respond to. So it's partly considering your own particular talents and skills and training. It's also what you intuitively feel drawn to, what you feel attracted by. I was talking to my order chapter recently about my interest in Joanna Macy and her workshops. And several of them, I think they were out of the... There's five of us altogether. One of them is really into it as well. And he goes out campaigning for the Green Party every time there's an election. And he's doing some voluntary work to solve the problem of fuel poverty, partly by awareness. But then the other three said pretty much things like, well, my response to the situation is to teach the Dharma. And I have complete respect for that. That is one of the ways you can respond, you know, to teach the Dharma. Because teaching the Dharma, practicing the Dharma, encouraging others to practice the Dharma, building the community, building the strength of the community is part of the solution. And actually, one of the areas Joanna Macy recommends is the area of promoting healthy and sustainable values for humanity. Because she's well aware that the values of materialist consumerism are destructive for the individual and for the environment. And I think I'd like to end by quoting something from the talk that Bhante gave in 1971 called Evolution or Extinction, A Buddhist View of Current World Problems. But don't worry, this is a hopeful bit. He's talking about his vision for spiritual community and the effect that spiritual community could have on the world. He's, I recommend this, by the way. This is one of the last chapters in his book called What is the Sangha? You probably know it. And so he talks about the situation that we're all in, you know, with all the things going wrong in the world and the dangers in the present situation. He recommends four things: self-development, engaging in spiritual community, withdrawing your support from groups that hinder the development, that hinder spiritual growth, hinder the development of true individuality, giving your support to groups that support spiritual growth or true individuality. And then he finishes off by saying this. I'll just read it in full. These then are the four strategies to get underway in order to begin to make a meaningful impact on world problems. A network of spiritual communities of all kinds, many of whose members would be in contact with one another, could exert a significant degree of influence, such as might shift the centre of gravity in world affairs. Spiritual communities have had a crucial impact in the past, and they may with sufficient vitality do so again. It doesn't matter how humble a level we are operating at, or how undramatic our work may be. The true individual is not so much the king of the jungle as the indefatigable earthworm. If enough earthworms burrow away under the foundations of even the most substantial building, the soil begins to loosen, it starts to crumble away, the foundations subside, and the whole building is liable to crack and collapse. Likewise, however powerful the existing order may seem, it is not invulnerable to the undermining influence of enough individuals working, whether directly or indirectly, in cooperation. You said Sangharakshita isn't a revolutionary. Anyway, he continues. A spiritual community is necessarily small. So the best we can hope for is a multiplicity of spiritual communities forming a sort of network through personal contact between their members. A silent, unseen influence is exerted in this way, which we must hope will be able, at some point, to shift the centre of gravity in world affairs from the conflict of groups to the cooperation of communities. If this were achieved, if the influence of the spiritual community were to outweigh that of the group, then humanity as a whole would have passed into a new, higher stage of development, a kind of higher evolution, as I like to call it, into what we might even describe as the fifth period of human history. I was delighted to read that. I have gained a tremendous amount from learning from Sangharakshita over the last 41 years actually. When I read that, I realised that the vision he has for humanity accords with my vision. My vision for humanity is that eventually the human race will mature enough spiritually to learn to live sustainably together, in a way which is good for the individual and good for the environment, good for community. And that we may go through some pretty dreadful times over the next two centuries, but we'll emerge out the other side of all that, having learned, you could say the hard way, how to live a really healthy and sustainable life. And that will be a new phase of human history, possibly the best phase we've ever known. So that's the vision of humanity that I look forward to. And in my own way, in my own little way, I'm actually working on. But I agree with Bhante that Dharma practice and nurturing one another in the Sangha is of tremendous value, because we are, in a small way, building the kind of sustainable, healthy society which the human race needs to learn how to live like this. Doesn't necessarily mean calling ourselves Buddhist, calling ourselves Buddhists, but having all of the values and the kind of practices that we've discovered within the Buddhist Sangha. So when we practice 21st century ethics, when we train as bodhisattvas within Triratna, and when we practice ethics on the level of self-talk, on the level of the relations with people in our households and our families and our local communities, when we take responsibility for the lifestyle choices we make, and the way that they affect people all over the world and affect future generations, when we do that, when we resource ourselves and sustain ourselves and encourage ourselves to have the strength to do that, then it's not just we who benefit. We do benefit. We get to live a really satisfying life. But the world benefits, and the world needs people to do that like never before. So that's the end of the talk.